The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now to begin this morning, my purpose in this hour is not to present any neat strategy. I would be the last person to be equipped to do that. You folks are the experts as to Asia and its needs and the strategies that may work here. But really what I want to do is stretch every one of us and sort of throw at you a number of models, ideas, which can become grist for our mill as we begin thinking about perhaps a new strategy for Asia and some things that others have tried and we might find successful too. Now, I think what we want to avoid is an attitude that we've all seen it in one place or another, but I found it the most frustrating in Spain. Our mission board sent me to Spain in the late 70s to spend a month trying to decide what kind of strategy we might develop for a new work in Spain. And I visited many different evangelical pastors in Spain and missionaries, and what frustrated me was an attitude that if it works in Latin America, don't try it here. And because I had a Latin American background, I was suspect. And that irritated me. Now, I realize that Spain is very different than Latin America. But some of the old colonial pride was coming through, I think, and an attitude that, if you're coming from Latin America, you're stepping up pretty high if you come to our country, and don't bring any of your methodology with you. Now, I don't want to be judgmental, but I ran into that attitude pretty loud and clear, and others told me that they had bucked the same problem. Now, that we want to avoid. And remember what we said about componentry. The automobile that can be manufactured from many different sources and countries, and yet when it's put together, it works. And I think that holds true. The mission world is big and complex, but it is also amazingly small and similar, because the same problems and relationships are found everywhere, and the missionary mandate is universal. And therefore, I think we can learn from one another, and that's what I want to talk about this morning. Let's go for a moment to page 3 to begin with. There are a couple of things that we ought to keep in mind as we begin to consider possible strategies, new approaches that we might develop. Now, our problem here is that we have to recognize that our countries differ. They differ a lot. And the differences are not just in social economic conditions, but also in the level of receptivity and the cultural influences that make such a difference in the way we approach evangelism and the churches that we develop. And from the Philippines to Japan, there are going to be lots of variations, and Taiwan in between, and Hong Kong, unique again in its own way. So we bear that in mind. I've thrown together here approximately 20 conditions which strategists must keep in mind. I have it particularly in mind third world countries here. Serious unemployment in the cities. In some places, that is just an overriding concern that you never can forget. Poor public transportation. Well, obviously, that's not Japan, because Japan's not a third world country. But in some places, just scheduling meetings, how far apart you try to place your churches, is conditioned by the fact that public transportation is very poor. Long work days, little time or energy left. When we started our Bible studies in the homes in Mexico City, we would meet after 8:30 at night, because the men returned home late from work. The first thing they wanted to do was eat, and then we could get them for a half an hour, an hour of Bible studies before they fell asleep and went to bed. and the work schedule and the kind of conditions people are laboring under will affect even little things like when you have your home Bible study. High cost of city property and construction, big factor. Second hour today, we're going to talk about the whole question of church buildings, whether we want them, what we do with them, and if we have them, what should they look like? High cost of city property, too rapid immigration from rural areas, the accelerated urbanization, which is such a momentous problem. Stagnant city churches, mainline denominations. In my experience in Mexico, this was problem number one. I actually met resistance from the church leaders who weren't the least bit interested in attaching to their presbyteries a whole lot of slum churches. And their own churches were stagnant, even though they were surrounded by receptive people. But they were socially now separated from the people whom God had prepared for the gospel. And to me, that was just a mind blower. I couldn't imagine churches like that. Well, we have them in North America. It shouldn't surprise us when we have them someplace else. Maybe you have them in your country. Inadequately trained pastors, laypersons, questions of tribe and language churches. That's a big question in many places. What kind of churches do you form in the city? Should you go the tribal route? Should they be using the market language or go with the dialect? The lack of cooperation and networking. Ray Bakke has done a great service to urban mission by traveling around the world for World Vision, calling together people who are laboring in cities and beginning to network them, getting them to talk to one another and begin the important thing of networking those who are ministering in cities so that we can share resources, information, and also strategize together. An important ministry, networking. Lack of understanding of cities and urban evangelism. I find that so many of us working in cities find cities just a giant, perplexing places that we don't know how to get a handle on urban ministry. And so we just sort of go like a fisherman who is in a strange lake using baits he's not familiar with and someone's borrowed pole that he doesn't really know how to work. And you've seen fishermen like that, and they're fishing in the wrong place, they're using the wrong baits, they catch nothing, or maybe they find some sick fish that happens to wash up, and that they say there aren't any fish in this lake. Well, a lot of people don't think the city people can be evangelized either because they're always doing it wrong. 11, shuttle migration. I've identified that as an East African phenomenon, but I think there are forms of that here in Taiwan. There's forms of that in the Philippines and in a lot of places, shuttle migration. Maybe Hong Kong has its own variation. Don't you have kind of a shuttle back and forth between mainland China and Hong Kong now? Isn't there some back and forth going on? Who's from Hong Kong? Temporary, back and forth. Business people and others who will come in. Okay. A kind of shuttle migration. It has great potential, of course, and I'm sure you're aware of that and are using it. Good. Government restrictions. If we were meeting in the Middle East right now, we'd be talking about a whole different set of conditions and problems. You try urban evangelization in Libya, for example, or Tunisia, or just try it in Saudi Arabia, Muslim countries, entirely different atmosphere, different set of conditions. But interestingly, there are other places that are difficult because of government policies. Mexico, where we labored, is a tough place for planting churches because of government restrictions. Missionaries, most of them, are on six-month tourist visas. Every 6 months, you got to run down to Texas or Arizona and renew your tourist visa and hope the government official there lets you have it. But much more complicated than that is the fact that all church property is nationalized. And this came through after the revolution of 1920 because the Catholic Church owned just zillions of hectares of Mexican soil. And so they reacted against that by taking all ecclesiastical property away from the churches and nationalizing everything. All the churches have on the corner a little sign saying propiedad federal, federal property. Now, there's advantage to that because if you start getting stoned, the troops have to, the police have to protect you. But there are also disadvantages, tremendous disadvantages for church planting because it's used against the Protestants. You see? And the moment, the law is very vague, and the officials in each city will interpret it their way. For example, in some places, the difference between private worship and public worship would be 30 people. If you have 28, it's considered a home, culto familiar, family worship. But if you got 30, they could seize the home and federalize it, nationalize it. Another rule they use sometimes is whether the door is closed or stands ajar. Now, if the door is ajar, then that is public, and then it's illegal to have a worship service there, even if it's just 10 or 15 people. But if it's closed and every person has to knock, then it is private worship and it's okay. Well, you can imagine how you get around that. You just have this little girl with a house stand with a door and open it for everybody that comes in. But those are very subtle. And what happens is, in the body, when you're planting churches, is number one, landlords are scared if their tenant allows any kind of worship service going on, even a large Bible study, because he might lose his property if they federalize it. And then, of course, the local police come in, and this is a way of extorting money. They watch, and if they see there's some worship going on someplace, next day they're at the door and say, well, we're going to seize your house. Come on, get everything out. There's a truck here. We're going to take you away. Well, you plead, you scream, and you cry, and make a lot of noise, and then they say, well, okay, let's make a little understanding, and then, of course, you start paying rent to the police for your church building. All kinds of things happen. But it's because of a law that impinges on the mission strategy of multiplying churches, and it's a problem. Religion is considered a woman's matter. That's a condition that we find in many places, and it affects how we strategize. Do you even deal with women, or do you insist on going to the man in order to get at the supposed head of the family? 14, few quality Christian radio and TV programs by national. Now, maybe that's not a problem in your area. It is in many other places. Marxism in the school. Maybe you don't have that in your country, but in a lot of countries, the kids are learning Marxist ideology every day, and they come home with it, and it very soon affects the churches, and you've got to be preaching and teaching against the background of the fact that Marxist interpretations of life, history, conditions, government are being constantly filtered through to the children. The lack of basic services, water, sanitation among the masses, the political unrest, guerrilla activity, death squads, the evangelical theology which provides no social political understanding or response to Marxism. We've been dealing with that indirectly this week. Underdevelopment of Christian ethical consciousness. This is a major problem. How do we help the lot live in Sodom when they're there on mission, or when they're there and can't leave? But how do they live righteously unless there is a much deeper perception of social ethics than very often we're working with? And then the unreached ethnic and language groups in the city. One of the big challenges, I think. Now, let's go back to page one for a moment. As we look at various strategies and models of urban mission, there are at least six things we have to ask, six questions to evaluate. First of all, is the Bible carefully used, both in presenting the message of the Lord Jesus and in shaping the strategy, determining the goal? Is the Bible and its authority over mission strategy genuinely respected? Two, are people carefully and respectfully dealt with? Are we avoiding a kind of religious manipulation? Are people dealt with not as objects to be manipulated and made to do what we want them to do, even religious actions, but are they dealt with as truly responsible image bearers of God, people of great value and worth? Now, their temporal as well as their eternal needs taken seriously. In North America today, there's a lot of discussion going on about the ethics of evangelism. It's a very interesting discussion. And a number of strategies, methods are being questioned as to their manipulative character. And I think that as missionaries, we must always be very sensitive to this area, how we deal with people. And I think we get plenty of instruction on that from our Lord Jesus and how he dealt with those whom he spoke to the word of truth. Three is biblical holistic church growth resulting from it. Now, this is a big one. And you remember earlier this week I presented five kinds of growth that we should be looking for in the churches we plant: numerical and spiritual and organizational and incarnational growth, and then growth in global mission. Now, that's one of the tests we must put to the churches that we see developing. And I think that from the very beginning of a church planting program, those five criteria should be applied. And from the very first service, something of all five should be present. Number four, is the community impacted as a result of the mission activity? Is the community being impacted? Is it? That's carrying through on that incarnational approach, I suppose. But you have to ask, is the place any different because the church has been there for some months or years? 2 years ago, when I was in Korea and visited some of the red light areas, because Korea has these prostitution zones, I was terribly distressed to see in a couple of places, particularly in Busan, a large Presbyterian church immediately, like one wall, adjacent to a red light area. And it stood there for years. And the people of the church, and it was a large church in both cases, every time they went to service, passed both the girls and their customers. But, you know, there they went. The one to go say their prayers and the others to prostitute, and somehow nothing was happening. And I wonder if that in some other ways isn't happening in a lot of our other places. Are we leavening? Are we salt? Are we light? Or are we sort of a religious huddle that doesn't make any difference to the community around us? Tough question to ask of any strategy or model we're dealing with. Number five, are the methods in line with the goal and appropriate to the community? Now, pretty soon we're going to talk about goals. And it's the difference, I suppose, between saying, I'm going fishing, or saying, I'm going after smallmouth bass. There's a whale of a difference. Excuse the metaphor. I have a son who is a genius with a fly rod and smallmouth bass. He claims that he thinks like a bass. And when you watch him, and when you're not catching anything and he's pulling in his fifth or sixth, you begin to think he does think like a bass. But when he goes after bass with that extremely light line he uses, he likes to, you know, get a 6 or 7 pound bass on a 1 pound monofilament line. That's his great talent. He doesn't just take any bait or use any method. He's not after pike, he's not after perch, he's not after bluegill, he's not after shark. He is after smallmouth bass, and he knows how they think and what kind of line, what kind of bait, what kind of pole, and where to go. You see, his goals are specific, and so all the methods along the way tie in with what he's aiming at. Now, many times we go into the city and we're doing mission work. See? We're doing our thing. And then if we get anything in the bucket, it's a strange assortment, and we get a very hard, Number six, how does it contribute positively to the ultimate goal, the advancement of the kingdom of God? And I guess that's the ultimate test we have to place alongside every one of our goals. Even the church is the penultimate. The ultimate is the kingdom. All our strategies, all our methods are unto the kingdom. Now, what you have in section one here, page one, is a potpourri of goals. I've picked these up in a lot of different places. And I like to ask missionaries when they describe what they're doing, what is your goal? What is your goal? What are you out to do, to get, to achieve? What do you want to see here in 10 years? And that sometimes can get a bit embarrassing because we tend to be rather vague. And here's a list of 20 different ones that have been suggested. Maybe you want to add some. Wish we had time to apply to some small groups to give this assignment to state some specific goals. Many of these are just way too vague. But then the second section here has to do with the strategies that match goals. Sometimes they don't match them. There you have 40 different strategies that I've picked up being used around the world. Page. Who was that? Well, we pray that there's nothing serious that's causing the phone call. Now, here on page two, you see again a collection of strategies that are being used, and all of them have some value. I don't suppose any of them is worthless. And many of them are exceedingly important. But let's look now for a moment at models which are used to implement strategies with specific goals in mind. And some of these models I've put on this extra page with all the circles and lines. I'm going to begin with one that's not on this page. We'll call it the Acapulco strategy of the PCA. The Acapulco strategy is an interesting one because it uses many of the latest concepts, one of them being the team approach. The second, the use of neutral locations for evangelistic encounter, neutral locations, and I'll explain that in a moment. Another interesting thing about this is it's aimed at the middle class, almost upper class segment of the Acapulco population, which has generally been very difficult to reach. And a fourth thing that's very appealing to me is it's time frame. The director of this mission has vowed that in 10 years from the initiation of this strategy in Acapulco, every missionary will be out. 10 years is it. Go in, do the job, get out. And that's announced to the national churches loud and clear so that they know they won't have to eventually invite the missionaries to leave or have all kinds of problems, as we often do in Latin America. But It began 1980. It's going to be over in 1990, and then the church will be on its own. Okay, what's the goal of the Acapulco strategy? Well, the goal is a presbytery. This is a Presbyterian program. A presbytery which consists, by definition, of a minimum of 5 organized churches with pastor, elders, and deacons. The pastors have to be salaried by the church, and the church has to have a building. So they know what they've got to have. Now, besides the 5 churches, they'll have a lot of mission congregations, preaching points, and so forth. But they have very clearly, as defined by the Presbyterian Book of Order, what they should have by 1990. A self-supporting presbytery, 5 churches, mission congregations, 5 pastors, X number of elders and deacons, and everything in place. Okay. They have a team of missionaries. If I recall correctly, they have 4 married couples, 2 single women, and then it's augmented by auxiliary team members who come in for 1 or 2 years knowing Spanish and with certain particular gifts, such as music, for example. They brought in a music expert so that these churches would all have the beginnings of a choir and someone who could play a piano or an organ or a guitar or something. They brought in the music man and a couple with particular gifts in that area. And they came in, and for 2 years, they got the music program started in each of the 5 locations. And then out, go somewhere else. The team, interestingly, was designated or chosen with a variety of gifts in mind. Now, this is beginning, this whole team approach, of course, is getting more hybrid all the time. And the Acapulco team strategy began to utilize some of the ideas in which various gifts were looked for so that there would be a balance. Not everybody would be more or less the same on the team, but there would be a pluriformity of gifts, expertise, and so forth. Okay, now, one of the things they did is
she has one place as primary assignment, and then secondary assignments in the another place, or maybe a third place. And that is one facet of the strategy. Now, I mentioned that they use neutral territory, neutral location, for evangelistic contact. I said that their target population is the middle and upper class. Let me explain something about Acapulco. Acapulco is now a city of 1.25 million. By the way, I hadn't been in Acapulco since 1978. And when I left in 1968, I had been there, left there in about 1968, the population was 250,000. And when I came back a few years ago, it was 1,250,000. In about 10 years, 12 years, it had gained 1 million people. Tremendous growth. Now, Acapulco, how many have been to Acapulco? Have you ever, John and Jackie Kennedy honeymoon there, and movie stars have their second homes there. Well, Acapulco is a port city on the Pacific in southwestern Mexico. Here's the Pacific Ocean. The city, the tourist strip is all along the bay, and the Acapulco that I knew very well back in the 60s, this was all slum area. And these were the people that worked in the hotels, these fantastic hotels all around the bay. Today, now this is a mountain. A mountain encloses the city area like a rim all around the eastern fringe of the city. Now, Today, about 1 million people live in this area. Here's where the slum people are. And these are the squatters, these are the slums. Now, the city is doing quite a bit to put in sanitation and water and so forth into this area, but this is where about 1 million people live. Here, that used to be all slums, is now very, very upper-class residential living. So the city has just gone through a tremendous change in a little over a decade. And this property is all very expensive. Now, this is the target area. The people that are targeted are hotel managers, restaurant owners. One of the elders that I met was the owner of the largest taxi cab company in the city, a businessman, very prosperous, achiever-type people. Now, where do they make their initial contact? They make their initial contact not in the churches. Not in the churches. They make their initial contact usually in restaurants and fine dining rooms in hotels. And they run a series at least twice a year of public events in which they rent, now they put money into this, they rent a fine dining room in a first-rate hotel or restaurant, fly in a top-notch speaker of some kind of international renown who will speak on a topic that is a real felt need, something these businessmen who are trying to raise families in a Sodom like Acapulco are concerned about. How to raise teenagers in today's world, drugs among youth, marriage conflicts, all kinds of, you know, topics that class will be very interested in. Even sometimes economic questions. But always the speakers are committed Christians who are gifted in both their particular field of expertise of wide interest and putting in the Christian punchline and weaving that into their message. Now, what do? Well, they invite people to these dinners. And beginning first with a small circle of missionary contacts, their first meetings were at the best hotel, the Prince's Hotel in Acapulco. And that's the turf that these folks that they're targeting feel comfortable with. They're used to going to those places. You invite them to some little coffee shop down the street, they're not going to go. But you give them an invitation to the Prince's Hotel, and yeah, they might show up. And you tell them, we're going to have this speaker who's flying in from New York, and he's going to be talking on this subject. And you have a nice little thing printed up, and you give it to him. He'll be there. He's your guest. And he hears the gospel, and you begin a relationship. And that's where they've been working. Very interesting. And they do this. They generally do not invite people to the church. Cold turkey. After they've made the contact, started building relationships, of course. But they always begin in very neutral places, chosen not because Christians go there, but because the people they want to reach are very comfortable there. It costs a few bucks, but it's working. Well, they're halfway through this strategy. It's 1985. They've got four churches started. They're going very well. They're using TEE exclusively for leadership training. And I would say they're probably ahead of schedule in the development of this strategy. The churches are nice. In fact, the leading church, the first one that started, is the Maranatha Church. Billy Graham, who has a condo in Acapulco, I understand. He's there usually to rest up after one of his crusades. Frequently worships at this church when he's in Acapulco. You say, well, he doesn't speak Spanish. Well, this church began immediately with simultaneous translation in two other languages. The services are in Spanish, but they're aiming at an international crowd. People, Spanish-speaking people who have business associates who speak French or English. And so, you know, they went for it. They went for it. The music is top-notch. The organist, the pianist are converted nightclub players. Now, the time I preached there a couple years ago, I think that the pianist had been playing in his place of work till about 4 in the morning, and the music was a little bit But it's the kind of music, and it's the beat, and it's the pizzazz that that crowd feels comfortable with. And the whole service and everything they do is first rate. And they're winning a class that, I'll tell you, my days in Mexico was virtually unreachable. Maybe it was because we didn't think of trying these methods. I don't know. They've got a goal. They've got a strategy that meets it, and they're going for it. Now, into that goal must be included not just a presbytery with five churches, but a presbytery that's self-supporting, upper middle class, and so forth. When you express a goal, you describe it, you flesh it out. What you're aiming for. You could have a presbytery goal in a slum area that would look different after your strategy been developed. Any questions about this? Anybody want to ask me about the problems in this strategy?
I am curious, in their goals that they have set here, as part of their plan and their ultimate goals to reach those people in the mountains.
Now you put your finger on a sore spot. The question is their ultimate goal to reach the people in the mountains? And the answer is, I'm afraid not. And one missionary on the team, and I hope I'm not betraying any secrets here, one missionary on the team has broken out of the strategy, and now with the blessing of his teammates, and has begun church planting over here, or in the mountains, over the hill. But the original goal was not. And that was an accommodation they made because of one missionary's deep sensitivity to the fact that they were not reaching the masses. Now, the argument that is used is, number one, if we're ever going to help those masses, we've got to reach this class and build some Christian ethical consciousness into them. Number two, if we're going to have a presbytery that's self-sustaining in 10 years, we've got to get at the people with that leadership potential, with the financial resources that can do it. And number three, you can't mix them. Latin America divides, and when churches split in Latin America, they divide over social economic lines. If it's Africa, it's tribal. If it's India, it's caste. And in Latin America, maybe the Philippines, it's social economic. Now, this is a hard reality, but it's there. Now, if a real social ethic, a Christian social ethic, can be built into that presbytery, then the people in the hills will be reached and will be benefited. But if they follow the pattern that so many churches follow, of being very exclusive to their own class and rather callous toward the others, apart from some benevolence a few times a year, then it will have failed in a major area, even though it may have succeeded according to the terms of the goal that was stated.
Dr. Greenway, are you aware of areas where that has actually happened, where the upper middle or upper class has been reached, and it has gone to the point where they will for the masses or benefit the masses in a significant way?
I wish I could say yes to that question. The question was, have we seen places where the upper classes were reached, and after they became Christian, they made significant differences in the life of the poor? I'm sure somewhere this is happening. But I'm afraid the instances where it doesn't happen are more numerous. And of those, I could cite a number.
Do you suggest that as new work has started and as goals are established, that it's pretty important to determine whether it's going to, what ethnic group is going to be, and what social, where on the social rung they are and all that?
The question is, when you set out and you develop a strategy and you state your goals, whether you should pinpoint the social, economic, or ethnic group that you're targeting. Is that correct, the question? I tend to think it is, in most instances.
Now, tomorrow, when we look at demographic realities in the service of urban mission, we're going to deal with this more concretely, and I'll explain more of what I have in mind. But I think in most cases, the most recent studies in missions would suggest that we're missing the boat if we do not target our populations.
To say it's going to be in this district, that is not adequate.
It depends on what's in the district. Now, maybe that district is narrow enough to be homogeneous. But there will be people in any district, in any city, that can be reached through the fellow who just goes fishing. Sometimes he catches the biggest fish. You all know the stories. This poor guy, he doesn't know which bait to use, but he throws it out there and bang, he gets the biggest one of the day. And sometimes it happens in missions. But usually it's the one who knows what he's after. And he knows the language, he knows the culture, he knows the sensitivities of that group, he knows where they're hurting, their felt needs, and he goes for it. Usually that's a better way. That also has some problems. But I'll be talking about that tomorrow when we talk about demographics.
My question is how many personnel were involved in that strategy?
Okay, now you're getting at one of the weaknesses.
Well, that would be the budget that was
Well, there are about a half dozen families and single persons involved. Plus the auxiliary people, the short-termers that are brought in for specific things that they do. But you ask about who are involved, how many, and I thought you were going to ask, is it all expatriates or are nationals on the team? This particular team approach is strictly expatriate. Now that is one of the weak areas that I see in the strategy. Because already they're having enormous difficulty getting pastors for these churches. Now that's not entirely because it has expatriate leadership from the beginning, but these churches are reflecting a very American model of what a church looks like. And even though these are excellent missionaries who know the language superbly well and are very contextualized, nevertheless, we all carry our baggage with us, and it shows up especially when the team is composed entirely of expatriates. However, there's another problem, and that isn't entirely the fault of the team at all. It's part of the fact that they're aiming at a segment of the society which the church and the existing Presbyterian seminaries in Mexico are not preparing leadership for. They're having trouble finding pastors for these churches. They issue a number of calls to different pastors, and they all get turned down. They haven't gotten one pastor yet to accept a call to these churches. Why? Because they're scared. The Presbyterian seminaries in Mexico are not preparing pastors for this class. And I think they're probably going to have to go outside of the country or find some international type person who's not afraid of businessmen who drive up to church in a Mercedes or who want to take the pastor and his wife for dinner at the Prince's Hotel. And most of us would find it hard to handle that. The Prince's Hotel, but we have a volunteer here. The Prince's Hotel, by the way, and if I get time sometime during our week together, I want to tell you a story about Howard Hughes and the Prince's Hotel. Howard Hughes died at the Prince's Hotel. The death certificate said he died in Houston, but he was dead at the court before they put him on a plane in Mexico. And the Prince's Hotel is one of the 10 best hotels in the world. And it is also the center of chocolate desserts. All the chocoholics of the world go to the Prince's to enjoy chocolate desserts, the like of which only the Prince's produces. And the story I want to tell you, and I'm just whetting your appetite. You're going to...
Oh, Daddy.
All right, I won't say anything more. We're on...
We're going to postpone the picture till 10:35.
All right, by popular demand. Let me tell you this story. It's We only looked at one model here, forgive me, but we'll get back. At the Maranatha Church, one of the elders is a man by the, I'll just call him Willie, Wilhelm is his name. He is the chief pastry chef at the Prince's Hotel, this Chocoholic's Palace there in Acapulco. Wilhelm was born and raised in Europe. His wife is Swiss. He was raised in a Christian home, but he left the church at 18 after being confirmed and never went back. And he climbed the long ladder of chefing internationally. He has been in Hong Kong, in Singapore, traveling from one hotel to another, making very high income, as top chefs can, until finally he became named the chief pastry chef of the Prince's Hotel in Acapulco. His specialization, of course, would be chocolate desserts. He took me through the kitchens there and showed me. He's got all kinds of people working on these desserts under him, and it's just a dreamland of calories and tantalizing desserts. Wilhelm was a restless individual, constantly climbing, always looking for a higher position, a more prestigious hotel to become the chef at, and so forth. And a few years ago, he was at the Princess, living in one of their beautiful homes that they provide on their grounds just across the golf links, the private golf links of the hotel. And the manager came out on a golf cart and said, Willie, you got to get back. Our special guest has arrived. The special guest was Howard Hughes, the billionaire. And Howard Hughes had rented the entire top floor of the Prince's Hotel. Now, the nightly rates for each room would, you know, burst our budget for a year. But he had taken the entire top floor, and he moved in with his servants, about 80 of them, all to attend this now decrepit drug addicted Howard Hughes. And he immediately asked for a jelly roll. And that's why Willie, the pastry chef, was called off the golf links at Sunday afternoon, because Howard Hughes, upon arrival, insisted on a jelly roll. So Willie made him the best jelly roll. He hadn't made jelly rolls in quite a while, but he said, well, how do you make a jelly roll? He said, I used fresh strawberries. By the way, all the ingredients are flown in from around the world. He said it's the only place he's ever worked where he has no limit to his budget. The bottom line at the Prince's Hotel is to be the top pastry serving hotel in the world, cost what it may. And so he flies in his ingredients from all over. And he makes Howard Hughes the best jelly roll he could possibly make. So it's sent up, and a few minutes later, one of the bodyguards comes down and says, hey, it's delicious, but the boss doesn't like it. You got to try again. So, well, you know, Willie doesn't have that happen too often. So he said, well, I made another one. And he says, he wanted it a little more sweeter and more gook on the top. So he says he put it on, short while later, I was just putting my apron off, he said, and ready to go home. It was evening, and there came the bodyguard back and said, the boss still isn't satisfied. So tomorrow we're sending a jet to the Bahamas where the boss can get the right kind of jelly roll, and he's going to bring you one, and you have to duplicate it. So the next morning at dawn, a jet took off from the Acapulco airport, went to the Bahamas to a certain hotel where Hughes had been previously, and by evening there it landed with a package, and Willie had it delivered there in the kitchen, and he said, boy, I opened that. He said, I really wondered, who's the cook there in the Bahamas that's making a jelly roll that I can't duplicate? And he says, I opened it, and there it was. He says, the ookiest, cheapest, jelly roll wrapped in plastic, the kind children buy on the way home from school on the street. And that's what this billionaire wants. It's all he wants to eat, one jelly roll after another. So he said, for weeks I had to do this. Every day, another jelly roll. And that's what Howard Hughes, by that time, had decided he didn't like the view. Now, the Prince's Hotel has one of the most fantastic views of the Pacific Ocean you can imagine. Howard Hughes had big rolls of brown paper brought in and all the windows pasted shut. The whole top floor, imagine what it looked like from the beach. All the top floor, all the windows taped shut, because he didn't want any light in. So here are his 82 servants all having to miss the view. And as they sat in semi-darkness, because that's the way Hughes wanted it. And then Hughes died. They stuffed him on a plane and flew him to Houston and said he died there. And they're still fighting over his billions. Well, Wilhelm began to think. He thought, here, this man has gotten in life what I wanted. You know, climb, 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 get more, earn more money. And finally he gets to the top, and what does he want? Sticky jelly rolls and a darkened room. And he dies like a dog, and they stuff his body in a plane and lie about his death certificate. On a certain Sunday morning, soon after Hughes died, Wilhelm was walking the beach with his black Labrador and thinking about this. Meanwhile, his wife had gotten religion, and he was disgusted with her. She had gone to a retreat with some women of the Maranatha Church. And Jay Adams, the psychologist, Christian counselor, was the speaker. And the woman got so mad the first day she wanted to go home, but she had ridden with other women and they were 3 days' drive away, so she couldn't go home. She stuck it out. By the third day, she was gulping in everything he said. The end of the week, on the way home in the car, she received Christ. Well, this was sort of bugging Wilhelm because, you know, living with a woman who's gotten religion can be a pretty, you know, a disgusting thing when she doesn't want to do everything anymore. And he was walking the beach wondering what life's all about. And then he said, I did something that I never thought I'd do. I went home and put my suit on. And I went to that crazy church where my wife was going. And they tell me in the church that halfway through the service, they have a share time and anyone can come with prayer requests. And here, the chief chef of the Prince's Hotel stands up and says, I don't know what I'm doing here. I haven't been in church in so many years. But all I know is that my life is empty, and what I've been trying to get isn't worth getting. Will anybody pray for me here? And that afternoon, Wilhelm, the chef, received Christ. He's now an elder in that church. He's now the president of the Gideons of Acapulco. And a life completely turned around. And interestingly, he stopped climbing. He says, I don't want to change hotels anymore. He says, I've gotten all I want. And his two children are in Christian colleges in the States, and his life turned around. So he attributes the Lord's using Howard Hughes, who died so wretchedly, as one of the factors toward his conversion. That was a long story, wasn't it?